Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
I had to get a lawyer and everything.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotaro. This is episode 152, a talk with Elzai. Elzai got his start as an MC in the now-famous Detroit rap scene of the 1990s, going to shows and open mics alongside some of the city's great talent like Guilty Simpson, Royce the 5'9", Fat Cat, Invincible, Proof, Eminem, and Slum Village. In 2001, Elzai would join Slum Village after J. Dilla left the group. He would remain with them for nearly a decade, leaving in 2010 amidst drama with the other members and their record label. Elzai's first major solo release was an album-length re-envisioning of Nas's Illmatic, entitled Elmatic. It met great critical and popular success. His brand new album, inspired by his struggles with depression, is called Lead Poison. We met up with Elzai at Crosstown Studios in Harlem. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cipher as soon as it drops, subscribe on iTunes. Once you do that, you'll be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you should check out our interview with another key member of the Detroit hip-hop scene, Invincible, on episode 5. Also consider helping the show by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. If even a quarter of our listeners contributed a dollar a month, it would go a long way towards making the show sustainable. If you're curious about any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what we're up to, on the air and in the wider world. And now, here's the only man brave enough to remake Illmatic and get away with it, Elzai.
You know, in Detroit, obviously, you spent a lot of time at the hip-hop shop and doing a lot of open mic stuff. Yeah. And what was the craziest thing you ever saw someone do at an open mic?
The craziest thing? I don't know. Like, I remember seeing Eminem battle at the open mic and just totally demolish somebody. And then I seen a Proof battle, and Proof was battling this guy named Tita Pimp. Mm. And he made the P-I-M-P stand for Proof Is My Papa. And I just remember everybody just wilding out off of that. Nice. It was crazy.
And, you know, I was looking up to stuff about you for this, and I saw you said that Chris Budd is your cousin,
yeah,
right?
Yep.
Was kind of a big early influence. And so I tried to find songs from him, and the one that I could find sounded very, very different than your stuff. It kind of had that almost like a Southern feel to it a little bit.
Yeah.
At least the song that I heard. In what ways was he an influence?
Chris Budd was like the man in my neighborhood. Everybody looked up to him, like all the kids. He pretty much introduced me like to hip hop, like live in the flesh, like as the culture, you know what I'm saying? Like I was, because, you know, I always heard hip hop growing up, but I seen it with him in the way that he dressed and the way that he rhymed. Yeah, he represents like the city, you know, Detroit, you know? So just seeing him do his thing and remembering like how skillful he was, like, and just the respect that he got for doing his thing, it made me want to do it. It had me like freestyling and, you know, writing rhymes at the age of 8, you know, so.
Wow. What was your, did you have a rap name at 8, 9 years old?
I didn't know what MC meant. I didn't know it meant move the crowd or whatever, or, you know, a master ceremony or anything like that. So I just knew everybody used MC like in a name. So I decided to be called MC, and it was called Master Chillin'. That's what I was.
Master Chillin'?
Master Chillin', yeah. Crazy, right?
Glad you changed your current name.
Yeah, I had mad names though. Like, you know, when you do this for a long time, you probably gonna go through maybe like 5, 6 names before you get to the one you like.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so you got you know, obviously landed on LZI, but it was originally just LZ,
yeah,
right? Because it came out of that, like, Jay-Z, A-Z, everyone has this two-letter type names.
Right, right.
How'd you add the I sound to the end?
It was a LZ. It was really, like, Lyrical Zenith or whatever. And then I wanted to be different, you know, so I decided to spell it out. And, like, the first attempt was LZI, and somebody around me was like, you should keep that. And the city had, like, not only it was, like, a hip-hop scene, but also it was kind of, like, a spiritual part of the scene as well, you know. And it was a lot of dudes on the scene, like, learning Hebrew and all that. One being Baten, you know. And Baten straight up told me, you know, he was like, man, your name means something. I'm like, what it mean? Like, said, God's spirit. Like, okay, cool. I'm gonna roll with that.
Wow.
Yeah.
There's a lot we could mention about Baten, but it got me thinking about your time in Slum Village and joining Slum Village.
Slum Village, a seminal Detroit hip-hop group formed in 1990, and the original lineup featured Baten, Jay Dilla, and T3. After Dilla left in 2001, LZI joined. Baten eventually left due to health complications, and both he and Dilla died in 2009 and 2006, respectively. T3 remains the sole surviving member of the original lineup.
When you joined there, you were a solo artist prior to that.
Yeah.
So you're used to filling up whole songs by yourself, you know, three verses, and you have to think of the hook and all this kind of stuff.
Right.
And then you get there and you're part of a group. You do, you know, one verse per song, if that.
Uh-huh.
What kind of adjustments did you have to make that happen?
The only adjustments I really had to make, because, I mean, I was in groups before I got into Slum Village. Like, I was in a group called 9 to 5. I was in a group called The Breakfast Club, where Dwelle was in a group with me. I was in a group called Fingers of Death, you know what I'm saying? But I had been in groups, like, before Slum. The only adjustment I felt like I had to make was I wanted to stay true to what Slum was about, you know? So I knew Slum was more about, like, vibe, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. You know, becoming a part of the beat, like, as far as, like, the instruments of the beat, like, riding certain parts in the track. So it was pretty much, like, style. So I didn't want to, you know, do what I did, you know, solo, you know, with the group. I just wanted to keep it like how it was.
Mm-hmm. You know, when we had Quelle Chris on a few weeks back, he was talking about how Fantastic Volume 1, when that came out, you know, and it was sort of a cassette that you got if you knew someone who knew someone in the group or whatever.
Yeah.
But that just kind of, like, totally took over his life and is still one of his favorite albums to this day.
I don't know, man. That thing blew my mind, man. It was something about the simplicity of it, you know, but with Dilla's production, the intricacy of the simplicity of that.
How did Fantastic Volume 1, like, how did you hear it? How did it hit you?
It's funny, man, because we was rocking the Slum before Volume 1. Like, I remember listening to songs like Hawk and Pucky. My style is rough enough for crushing niggas' tree trunks. I'm a man, no time to think what she wants. I'll be damned, stand, remember we ran. And Mountaintop. You know, just joints, ooh wee. Niggas wanna death when they know I got style. Word to my mama, she know I'm wrong. Niggas act ill when I come around the block. You know, before, like, Volume 1. But the first time I heard anything on Volume 1 was in a hip-hop shop when Jay Dilla came up in the spot. And I guess he just got finished recording it and just played it at the shop, like, once the open mic was over. Like, he played The Look of Love. Being the man and handling your bitch, what love got to do with it? SSV is all bullshit. You know what love is. Say it with me one time. You know what love is. Beat on some love shit. You know what love is. Beat on some love shit. Because I was cool with them brothers, man. You know, I got me a cassette tape. Like, I was real cool with Baten at the time, too. And Baten was slanging them out as, I think he had, like, a Lincoln or whatever. And he was, like, slanging them out, like, the back of the Lincoln, like, opening up the truck, along with the oils and the incense and everything he used to slang. Like, he was a hustler, for real. But that's how I heard it.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I was reading an interview with you from maybe like, I don't know, 04 or 05, somewhere around there. It was sort of after you had left the group.
Yeah.
And you talked about how towards the end of your time there, people, maybe not the group members, but people involved with them were talking about a strategy that you had called brand SV, meaning that like they wanted the group name to become important so that the who is actually in the group at any given time could kind of cycle in and out.
Yeah.
Looking at what has happened since then, what's going on with them now.
Since Elzai's time with Slum Village, the group has continued to go through lineup changes. Original member J Dilla's younger brother Illa J joined and then left the group. The current lineup consists of young RJ, the son of the group's label head RJ Rice, and T3.
Do you have any thoughts about the group, about like that brand SV plan? Do you think that they held to it or didn't, you know, take to it?
I'll say this. I run into people that say they really don't know who's in SV. So I guess I could just leave it at that, man. It looks like, you know, that plan that they had, like, it seemed like they're sticking to it. And, you know, God bless them for that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And after Baten passed, you talked about how people were saying, you know, right afterwards, you said people were saying stuff to you about him that you just couldn't believe.
Right.
What was some of the stuff people were saying? And why was it so upsetting to hear, like, in that context?
Man, I mean, you know, that was like a chapter. Like, reason why I was bringing up a lot of that stuff, because it was just so much going on behind the scenes with, like, paperwork not being correct. Like I said, it was trying to brand the group. So, you know, if I left, like, it would be okay. You know what I'm saying? Because you know, Slum Village is Slum Village and members come in and out, you know. So that's the only reason why I brought all that stuff up, is because I wanted people to know what I was dealing with behind closed doors.
Right.
And it was wild.
And so at that period when you were kind of like on the verge of leaving the group and speaking so openly about some of the behind the scenes stuff, some of the machinations with like the label and some of the people involved in the label and so forth, how did that end up playing? Did you get any pushback for any of that stuff?
Well, you know, like the people that I was talking about, like the label, they tried to take me to court.
Because of stuff you were saying in interviews?
Yeah, they was trying to make it seem like it was defamation. And so, you know, I went through this whole little process, you know what I'm saying? Like I had to get a lawyer and everything. And you know, they had served me papers and all that. But when it came down to the deposition and we were writing down the questions that we wanted him to answer, it was too real. Like we had too much information that backed up our statements. And if he denied it, we had the information and the evidence. If he didn't, then he would have lost anyway. So he just ended up dropping it. But it was a lot of money that I spent, you know, going through that process.
Yeah. You know, and so you started, you know, releasing more solo work, you know, with the preface and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So on the preface, you have that line, I think it's on the leak, where you talk about the Iron Sheik. You say, my shoe game crazy is the Iron Sheik.
Oh, yeah. Every time I drop something hot, you hear the sirens beat. It makes the water in the holes on a hydrant leak. You know my shoe game is crazy as the Iron Sheiks. Put a buzz in the streets that ain't been high in weeks.
Which is just like a fun detail that you really would have to be a wrestling fan to even pick up on. Who were some of your favorite wrestlers?
Oh, man. You know, I didn't fell off the wrestling game. But back in the day, it was like the British Bulldog and George Animal Steel and Ravishing Rick Rude, yeah. Million Dollar Man, all them. It was Hulk Hogan, that was my joint.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously one of your most famous songs from that era of your career is Motown 25. Pound for pound, I'm pretty live on the mic. Keep it flooded like Mike on Motown 25. Put your soul on ice and sold it for a whole known price. I'm nice, keep it not swole on dice.
You were
maybe 3 or 4 years old when the actual Motown 25 special aired.
Uh-huh.
Do you remember watching it?
Yes, I do.
You do?
Yeah. I was a big Michael Jackson fan. Like, that's all they was playing in the neighborhood. Like, I hear it in my house. My cousin stayed next door to me at the time and his family, and I go over there and they be playing Michael Jackson over there. I remember getting, like, my first beaded jacket with the zippers and everything. For my birthday, I had like a Michael Jackson book. You know what I'm saying? So I was a big Michael Jackson fan. And I remember that time, man, where he did that moonwalk on there.
Mm-hmm.
It was crazy.
And, you know, there was one other song in there I wanted to talk about, which was Colors, which at least in the hook sort of pays tribute to Ice-T's song of that name.
Yeah.
Death is my set, guess my religion. Color, 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 color.
The song, sing along to the
Was that a particularly influential song, or was it just you were writing a song on that theme and you kind of wanted to pay tribute? Like, how'd that come about?
I wouldn't say it was tribute, but it's almost kind of, it was like after I wrote it, you know, I'm like, oh yeah. It really came about just kind of like on a trip where I was just like, you know, it was like a tour. So I was in the car. And I, you know, I love to play with words. And I'm like, oh, okay. I just started noticing all these words had colors in them that we use every day. And I'm like, that'd be a cool little concept to do. So I just went on ahead and wrote it.
Mm-hmm. You have a couple of those concept songs on Preface and obviously on Lead Poison, which we'll get to in a minute.
Yeah.
Guessing Game is one of them. The one where you kind of challenge the listener. You break words in a half and you say, can I guess? Can you guess what I'm going to change this word into?
Yeah.
You want to play? How should we start? You try to guess the other half of this word. Were you smart? Allie, you see how easy that was? I say a line like, my head gets light when I'm catching the buzz. Cut. Got it, well, we can do another. Why was Sally shocked to find it was a nine inside my under? Age, no, we can really begin. Long as these beats keep the treats falling out of my pen.
How is writing those kind of songs as compared to like more straight ahead stuff, ones where you kind of set rules for yourself?
Yeah, yeah. It's fun. You know, I like it. I like the challenge, you know, of trying to do something that I feel like no one's ever done before.
Mm-hmm.
And to try to pull it off. Sometimes it works, sometimes it don't. But at the end of the day, I mean, you just got to, you know, I feel like it's if you stepping into the game, you got to take that oath to be innovative and carry that tradition.
Yeah. The thing about Guessing Game that stuck out to me was like, it's a direct challenge to the listener.
Yeah.
In a way that almost no rap songs are. It's like, are you smart enough to guess what I'm going to do to this rather than like, sit back and check it out. I just did this thing. It's sort of pre kind of getting at them to engage them.
Yeah. I like that. I mean, because it's like, you know, I liked when, certain artists would write a verse and then end up saying like a different word in the space that you thought that they were going to say another word to rhyme with the actual like mm-hmm. bar.
And, you know, I did want to get into Illmatic, which I actually saw you, I guess it must have been South by Southwest 2013 showcasing and doing almost entirely stuff from that record, which is great. The thing about that record is when you're writing for it, you have these limitations, like we were talking about with the other kind of song. You have to stay somewhat close to Nas's original flow.
Mm-hmm.
You have to periodically reference or use his original lyrics or give some kind of spin on them just to sort of show people where in the song you are.
Yeah.
Rappers are monkey flipping with the funky rhythm. I be kicking, musician, inflicting composition. A pain, I'm like Scarface, sniffing cocaine, holding an M16. See with the pen, I'm explaining. Yo, rappers are monkey flip on, gorilla stomp on. I'm out here with the dealers pumping, the killers dumping. Dead bodies in Lake Michigan and shake. Fishermen, pimps turning to pastures to fake. Bishops in the churches and prophets determined.
What was it like writing with those kind of limitations?
You know, I was a big fan of that album. And I'm still a big fan of it. It wasn't really hard at all, actually. Like,
something you were sort of doing before you sort of have the song in your head and changing words or kind of coming up with your own twist on it?
Yeah, because you know, the idea was given to me by this DJ named House Shoes.
Mm-hmm.
He thought it'd be cool if I did Illmatic over and called it Illmatic, and I'm like, okay, that's cool. And just like changing that up, you know, the title made me feel like, okay, well, you know, maybe I can do some of these verses and change it up just a little bit, add my spin on it. Yeah, so that's the approach I took for the whole record. Even with the music, like, you know, with it being, instead of using like the instrumentals, I decided to go with a live band. So I contacted Will Sessions and we got it together.
Yeah. And so in the process of doing that, of like really sitting down with most of the songs on Illmatic and sort of rewriting them, rearranging them, what kind of insights did you gain into the actual original Illmatic? At the end of the process, did you end up thinking about Illmatic any differently?
You know, Illmatic is the superior record, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's you know, it's in my top five. I could just say, I mean, you know, I gained a even more, a bigger appreciation for it, you know what I'm saying? Just, and what Nas did at that early age.
Right.
You know, he was a kid doing that record, so, and it was incredible.
And one particular lyric I want to ask about, because it feels like there's a story sort of hidden behind it. On Memory Lane, you have that line about Miss Nash. But I ain't want to leave without hitting my first blunt filled with chronic leaves. I choked up and couldn't breathe. That's the day I miss class. Smelling like twist grass. Miss Nash kicked me out because I'm not a kiss ass. So I visited why did she kick you out of class? What was the deal?
I don't know. I probably wasn't listening, you know. you know. And then I was kind of absent, you know, because of I felt like the teachers was hating on my style. Like, I mean, because, like I said, I was in the culture, so, you know, my pants might have sagged a little bit, and they didn't like that, so they might have said something I didn't like. So I'm like, man, I ain't got to take this on. I want to write anyway. I want to do my thing anyway. So, and, you know, she, I don't know, she kind of like hating on me. But,
and there was really a Miss Nash. It's not just a name you...
Nah, it's really
kiss ass.
Yeah, it's really a name. It's really a teacher. Like, yeah.
Nice.
That's funny though, man, that you say that, because you know, I had did like an interview recently, and they was telling me that they said I had like bike references in my songs. And I'm like, dang, I didn't even really realize I did that, but I'm just kind of pulling from memories, you know, that I've had, mm-hmm. and wasn't even aware that I probably used like 3-4 bike references in certain records. So I mean, y'all always pull from like real life.
Yeah.
Even though it might sound like I'm just rapping to rhyme something. Yeah.
And one last thing about Illmatic is, you know, when you released it, you know, it got a lot of acclaim. Obviously you toured around the world mm-hmm. with it, but you weren't in such a good place personally while all that was going on.
Mm-hmm.
So what was it like releasing a project that got a lot of acclaim when you maybe were depressed enough that you couldn't really appreciate people's reactions to it?
Yeah, it was crazy. It was crazy because, I mean, I really didn't want people to know what space I was in like that, because I didn't want people to feel I was defeated from what happened with the SV stuff. But it was just a combination of things at that time that was going on, which brought that on. So yeah, I was trying to like, you know, make sure, I was trying to act like I was good, you know what I'm saying? And looking back on it, I'm like, dang, I really didn't enjoy that period. I enjoyed that people enjoyed the record and people came up to me and said that they related to songs like the Memory Lane record and all that. But I'm like, man, I wish I could have enjoyed that time, because I did so much in that time. Like, I was in Japan, like, you know, I went everywhere with that joint. And yeah, it was kind of wild.
Now that, you know, maybe things are looking a little better for you, can you kind of look back on that period with a little more, you know, and get maybe some of that enjoyment that you missed out on the first
time? Yeah. I plan on enjoying it this time. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, this Lead Poison run, I'm a really like take it all in, you know, like Oxygen. So
yeah. And that, you know, definitely brings us to Lead Poison, which there is so much to talk about with it. You know, it deals with obviously heavy subjects,
mm-hmm.
but there's lots of lighter, more playful moments kind of scattered around.
Right.
How'd you work out that balance to have something that doesn't ignore the sort of heavier side of things, but also doesn't seem too overwhelmingly bleak?
Yeah. My influences was, people like Tim Burton and Slick Rick, you know what I'm saying? Where they could take situations and be a little bit more playful with it. And I really wanted that balance, because when I first started writing for Lead Poison, like, a lot of the material was dark. And I got a lot of that dark material just on my hard drive that I just felt like, I don't really want to do that. So, yeah, I really made that conscious decision. So it took me a minute to actually get that balance.
Will we hear any of the darker stuff ever?
I don't know. If it's a demand for it, I might put it out there. You know, I just figured people wouldn't want to hear the dark stuff now.
Well, actually, can you tell me maybe about one of the songs that you left out? Like, what was it called? What's it about? Just so people can kind of visualize the stuff you left off.
It was a song I had called Synesthesia. That's something that you have, like, when you are able to, like, hear music and see colors.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's different forms of it, but I have synesthesia.
Elzai isn't the first artist to talk to us about synesthesia. In episode 111, Jedi Mind Tricks' Vinny Paz told us how the condition affected his 2015 album, The Thief and the Fallen.
I have that. So when he gives me things, I see colors. And then when I see colors, colors remind me of other things. Like, the reason the cover of the album is the way it is, because the whole time I kept feeling blue.
Yeah, I was just talking about what made me feel blue and, you know, made me feel red and all that kind of stuff. And it was a little dark, you know? I was talking about some deep issues, yeah.
Wow. And so Medicine Man was the first song you wrote for the record, or I don't know if it was the first one or the first one you ended up keeping. Was it the very first one you wrote?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't.
But it was one that kind of turned a corner for you?
It was one where I had already knew, you know, because once I started, like, writing, like, you know, what I was going through, then I started feeling better. Because, you know, I had, like, records where it was, like, I was just rhyming, like, you know, and they were cool and all that, but I wasn't really feeling it. And then once I made that decision, like, man, maybe I need to get this out of me. I went through that dark stage where I was writing a lot of dark stuff. But then I found a balance. And then after that, that's when I wrote Medicine Man, because I knew that's what I had to do. I had to get it out. I needed an outlet to get it out.
And I was enlightened. I thanked them. We parted ways. I went home and started writing. Then noticed how the poison from within me turned to medicine. Once it had hit the page from the pencil that the lead was in. From the pencil that the lead was in.
And so, yeah, Medicine Man was probably one of the last records I recorded.
Wow. And it seems like, you know, like, writing this new album forced you to deal with some issues that date back to your mom passing in 98.
Mm-hmm.
So what was it like taking years of issues and pressure and all of that and kind of dealing with it all at once?
Mm-hmm. It felt good, man. It felt good to talk about it and get it out. You know, that's what the record is really all about. Like, at the end of the day, it's about people finding their outlet to get out the things that they need to make them feel better. You know what I'm saying? So getting that out, I could just slowly feel myself returning back to who I was. Like, oh, okay, this is cool. So yeah, that was the process.
Yeah. Do you wish maybe that you had begun to deal with that earlier or seen someone about some of this stuff earlier or something like that?
Yeah, but you know, I everything happens how it's supposed to happen. So I can't be mad at it.
Okay. And, you know, some of the inspirations you mentioned for the record in other places struck me as a little odd. You mentioned Shel Silverstein Larry David.
Yeah.
In what ways were they inspirations for you?
Because, like, the character that's on the album is actually me. You know what I'm saying? You know, so I was a big fan of Curb Your Enthusiasm. And a lot of people didn't know if that was really how Larry David acted or it was just him playing a character.
Nice.
So yeah, me, the raincoat, and the cloud.
Elzai is referring here to the cover of his latest album, Lead Poison.
That's really me, but in a more playful way. So right. that's where that comes from. Shel Silverstein, like, it was, you know, I just love those books and the poetry and how visual it was and how playful it was. And so when I found that balance and I was like, okay, yeah, I want to be a lot more playful. That's when a lot of that came in, like songs like Cloud.
Coming every week, it was a heavy leak, hourly above my head, but instead I wish it showered me with love. It was there when my mom's passed, when they cut my Comcast, when I witnessed the crime last and on the day of crime.
Even songs like Miss Right.
Yeah, we can start on this note. I dated a young miss who put words in my mouth. We just call it misquote. Deleted this one for good and went on date two with someone I couldn't relate to. Misunderstood. I wish thunder would clear from my existence.
You know, it's playful to me in that way. So that was my rendition of that.
Yeah. And talking about the cloud, you know, obviously the image of a black cloud following you around recurs on the record. Was that like an image that you were actually thinking of during the time you were really depressed, or was that, did that kind of come out afterwards as like, oh, this is a good metaphor for how I was feeling?
It just, you know, like for years, like, you know, I had people like Proof from like Paul Rosenberg tell me like, man, you got a glow about you, you know? And then when all that happened and when I was feeling the way I felt, I could tell like my energy was different. Like people was treating me different. Cause before, like I come in a room and everybody smiling or whatever, everybody, like they felt my energy. When that happened, it was like the total opposite. So I felt like, you know, it was something like, you know, getting in the way of my glow, like almost like a cloud hovering over me. So,
yeah. And you've mentioned in interviews, although it doesn't play directly a big part on the record, was alcohol and alcohol abuse.
Mm-hmm.
I know that was to some extent a real life issue for you. Why not work it more kind of directly into the album?
Because I had used it like a few times, you know, like I wouldn't say I was an alcoholic, but like I used it as a form of medicine, like, you know, to get over something, you know, like if I was feeling a certain kind of way, I might drink a little something to kind of make me feel better. It wasn't that often, but I felt like I needed to put it in there.
Right.
Yeah.
And you have the song Hello, which is a song from the point of view of the song itself, the song sort of talking and the very kind of meta song.
Is anyone out there? I'm just hoping you can hear me. I'm by myself all alone and nearly on the verge of breaking down. Like every single track in this very instrumental that was meant to make a sound. I'm not sure if what I'm gonna tell you you heard before, but if so, I'm probably saying it wrong. Cause if I wasn't, then maybe you wouldn't unintentionally play me every time that you were playing the song. You might have thought.
But I know there's also kind of another message in there, another layer in there about feeling trapped, feeling misunderstood.
Yeah.
Can you break that down for us a little?
Yeah. Just feeling like, you know, I'm not being heard, you know what I'm saying? And then, like you say, just feeling trapped, misunderstood, and just wanting the game to hear me, just wanting people to, like, actually, like, pay attention and listen. Mm-hmm. But in a, you know, in a different way, though. Like,
yeah. And so the healing process song about meditation.
During meditation, keep the back of your head in your bed adjacent. Inhale deep, exhale slow, think about nothing. Next, tell yourself that you were made in the image of the Father and let go of negative things. Why bother? It's not worth your time. The time's an illusion and you're not behind it, walking around blinded.
Uh-huh.
And so what are some of your favorite kind of meditation guides? I know you said you like audio self-help books. Like, what are some of the things that actually help you get into that mind state?
Yeah, I threw that on there because, like, when I was trying to, I was going through that process to heal myself, like, I would go on YouTube and I, like, check out meditation music and, like, self-help audio books. And I was like, well, since we on the topic of doing this, like, I felt like I wanted to make my own, you know, for people that may want to put it on, like, in the morning and you know, feel good about themselves, you know, maybe start a day off right.
Right. And I want to talk about Introverted for a second.
Okay.
I think it's such a powerful tune. On that song, and on a couple other songs, you have this thing where you kind of play around with, you kind of deconstruct idioms, right, expressions. I'm thinking about, you have the line, why would they want me to blow? They know an explosion kills.
Yeah.
My life's a cinema. I'm just now exposing reels, but why would they want me to blow? They know an explosion kills. What's behind enemy lines? They get plenty rewinds, infinity times, infinite infinity signs. You got some.
To take a phrase, a you know, bit of slang or an idiom everyone knows,
yeah,
and twist it, play around with it, try and get at what's inside it. Is that something that just as a rapper, as someone who deals with words, you do all the time? Do you only sort of do it when you're writing songs? Like, how does a line like that come about?
Yeah, pretty much when I'm writing songs, I love to twist words and paint pictures with like slang and just flip it. Like, I you know, I'm really big on wordplay. So, you know, anybody who listens to me know that I stand behind that because I came up, you know, listening to people like Lord Finesse and like Rakim and Slick Rick, Nas, you know, people I feel that's poetic, that make songs and put words together in a creative way. So I just feel like I need to carry that tradition.
Yeah. And you do this thing on Alienated that I love where you like set up a rhyme and then you'll, you know, use two words to sort of set the rhyme up or pick the rhyme up in the middle of a word and continue it to the next word.
I see why now they don't include me. I used to let that rude be. Behavior set the wrong attitude free. Then I thought.
Can you talk about that? Spreading out a rhyme over parts of words or more than one word, stuff like that?
I mean, it's just part of one of my techniques, you know, like that I've, you know, just one of the techniques that I use.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember, was there anyone in particular that came from or?
Nah, not really. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just me like evolving, like wanting to be better than I was before. So I'm always competing with myself pretty much. Like I always want to make my next record better than my last record.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm always trying to evolve.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And you have the 2 16s, you know, that came out sort of in advance of the album's kind of a big part of the album.
Yeah.
So it does two things, which is intentional, right? It's a very dense song in terms of rhyme, as if it was, you know, just kind of you spitting, but it's also a story. It's like a narrative.
I know y'all just want 2 16, so I'm just gonna spit it like that. For real. So that's exactly what you getting. Me spitting a couple written verses. The first is about Quentin, young and wild. Brung a child on this planet. He doesn't claim. Scoop chicks using his cousin name and plays a dozen games. Thinks he knows it.
And I assume that was sort of the concept of the song, to combine those two things, which is not something that almost ever happens.
Yeah.
How difficult was it to combine that?
I wouldn't say it was difficult at all. But I mean, the concept came about because, you know, if people know about, you know, MCing and the slang, you know, 2 16s is like, you know, basically like when somebody like, man, I want to hear you do 2 16s and that's it. They just really want to hear you spitting.
They don't want to hook. They don't want any.
Yeah, they don't want a hook. They don't want nothing. And so, you know, I was getting that a lot. Like, you know, I look online and it's like, yeah, I just want him to do 2 16s. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to do it a little different. I'll do 2 16-bar verses talking about 2 16-year-olds going through a situation. So that's how that came about.
Nice. And, you know, we were talking about the healing process a second ago, and it's, you know, a song literally, like its title says, about healing, about ways in which you can try to get past what is wrong.
Yeah.
Today is a fresh start, and the best part's being blessed with a test to progress, where you were less smart, whether or not you pass or fail, live a disaster, it got a master from when you took a class for Yale, where all spirits on the...
Why put that halfway through the record as opposed to at the end?
I don't want to make it seem like it was like a... It's kind of like a loose storyline, like almost kind of like how The Great Adventures of Slick Rick was. But I put that there because I wanted people to know that, the steps that I took, like certain steps that I took to actually like, you know, get to where I'm at today. And that's why you have like a poem towards the end called The Turning Point.
Render you unstoppable. Take the red lights from which we arose. Let them slide into your nervous system. Broil down, melting into bone marrow. Let it glow more relentlessly than fresh wheels that R. Kelly night at the skate rink.
That represents me, you know, becoming healthier after, like, you know, writing all the things out and getting it all out of me. And yeah, just that whole process.
Mm-hmm. And then kind of the lighter end of things, although presumably it wasn't actually a light situation for you in real life.
Yeah.
There's the Weedopedia song,
yeah.
Which is about a real life bust.
In front of my crib parked, I heard 10-4 roll down the window and I flew a thick cloud of endo. They cuffed me and booked me 20 minutes roughly. And my mug shot, my eyes bloodshot, I'm looking scruffy. Was locked up.
Got me thinking about that situation that, you know, you, as you say in the song, you had to do community service.
Uh-huh.
You've implied that you lost your license for a period.
Yeah.
And that's difficult enough for anyone,
mm-hmm.
but probably more difficult for someone who's a public figure.
Right.
How was that to deal as, you know, knowing that you're likely to be recognized while
right.
you're picking up garbage on the side of the road or taking right. the bus because you don't have a license?
Yeah, I mean, I try to be as low-key as I possibly could. Like, I pull my hat down over my head so wouldn't nobody notice me. I could tell some people did notice.
I was
going to
say, were you ever recognized?
Yeah, yeah. It was a couple times where, people was like, man, you look familiar. And I'm like, yeah, okay. Yeah, I get that a lot. You know what I'm saying? And I know I didn't fool everybody, but, and I didn't really get nobody coming up to me like, yo, you know, whatever, pointing their fingers. But I know some people recognize me, but It's all good.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, on the record, you make a pun out of the wait between albums, right? It's sort of a punchline for a second and then gone.
Yeah.
I'm stressed when by far I'm surely grating because I eat when I'm depressed. I'm so sorry for the
But for real, 4 years is a long time,
uh-huh.
Especially in, you know, today's like mixtape a week.
Right.
To be gone between records. Were you worried that audiences would forget about you?
I hope that they wouldn't. I had a talk with Charlie Tuna from Jurassic 5.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, man, when you throw your hat back out in that ring, you almost like a new MC. And you got to go through what new artists have to go through. Like, you got to go through that grind to get back. And I was like, yeah, you're right. So I knew I was going to have to do that. Yeah, it was a long time. It was a long hiatus. But in between all of that, I still was writing. I still was doing songs or whatever. So I'm sharper than ever. It's just all about playing the game the way it's played now, where, like you say, it's a mixtape every week or whatever. You know, people dropping like 3-4 projects like in 1 year. So I'm about to be on that grind.
You are. You're going to adjust how you release material. So there were a lot of news stories a little while ago about the Kickstarter, and there was a, you know, now infamous letter from someone who had supported your Kickstarter threatening, saying, oh, I'm going to get together a class action suit around, you know, people who donated this Kickstarter and didn't see anything.
Uh-huh.
Elzai began a crowdfunding campaign for a new album on Kickstarter in November of 2013. After nearly 2 years with no album and almost a full year without any update at all from the rapper, many fans and contributors got angry and disenchanted. One fan even took to the comments section of Kickstarter to threaten a class action lawsuit and solicited other fans to be plaintiffs.
Did that ever turn into anything?
Nah, it didn't turn into anything. It was claims, pretty much. Like, it was false accusations, you know what I'm saying, of somebody, I don't know, like, I don't know who it was, but it wasn't real. You know what I'm saying? So once I sat back and I thought, like, oh, yeah, this isn't going to hurt me, like, because an album is done. And it was dope, too, because they put that out there a day before we decided to do our campaign. So that's how I knew it was divine. Like, that's how I knew it was a positive thing instead of a negative thing. And everybody around me got excited, too. They was like, yeah, man, you know, because the world didn't know an album was done or anything. But the people who did, they was like, wow, this is probably one of the best things that could have happened to you.
Wow. And, you know, you've often said that if you weren't rapping, you would be writing screenplays.
Yeah.
You have a great song about a vampire on the new album that is very visual, very sort of almost cinematic.
She poured some red wine, I reached for a cup to sip. Did I drink blood or was I bleeding from my upper lip? I stood up to check my appearance in the mirror. Looked behind me, didn't see her, but could totally hear her. She asked me, would I like to live forever? I turned around, she was still on the couch, which made it clearer that she either practiced witchcraft or she might be.
Any big screenplay ideas you're toying with right now?
Not really, but I plan on getting into that later on. Yeah.
Very cool. And you know, you've talked a couple times here about hearing Lead Poison as like not exactly a concept album, but sort of a loose concept, kind of loosely tells a story.
Mm-hmm.
And you do have skits to connect at least some of the songs.
Yeah.
Other than Great Adventures of Slick Rick, did you have any models for that?
That was pretty much the model for that, man. Mm-hmm. But I'm a fan of like conceptual records. Like, one of my favorite records is a Death Certificate by Ice Cube.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I love that record. It's so visual. You know what I'm saying? The storytelling is amazing.
Fresh out of school because I was a high school grad. Got to get a job because I was a high school dad. Wish I got paid by a rapper to the nation, but that's not likely. So here's my application. Pass it to the man at AT&T. Because when I was in school, I got the but there's no SC for this youngster. I didn't have no money, so now I gotta punch the clock, gotta slay.
And he did something with an album that I feel like no one has yet to do. You know what I'm saying? As far as like it was like a double CD almost. Yeah, man, it's just one of my favorite albums, man. If no one's ever heard it, they need to check it out.
Yeah. So obviously, you know, I have to ask about your hat. You're wearing a Dilla tribute hat.
Yeah.
And since you knew him, obviously, like you were saying back since the beginnings of Slum Village, if not before.
Uh-huh.
I was curious about your reaction to what seems to be kind of a steady stream of tributes and posthumous projects and, you know, memorials and stuff that seems to have happened, you know, almost continually for the 10 years since his passing.
Yeah. I love the fact that people keeping his name out there. You know, I want the younger generation and the generation after them to keep his name out there. But I also want to make sure that the family get their money. You know, whatever they putting out there, like whether it's like a CD, whether it's a memorial, whatever, like whatever they doing to generate some kind of money. Mm-hmm. I just want the family to get that, you know, to be able to benefit off of it.
Right. That makes sense. What is something about Dilla that most people wouldn't know?
Wow. Dilla, and I haven't seen it before, but I mean, yeah, Dilla's a great, he was a great dancer, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Dilla could dance. Like, he could dance, DJ, sing, you know what I'm saying?
Sing.
Yeah. That was a few things.
Nice. You know, obviously you got your start at the hip hop shop and this scene that is now known mostly because of a movie. What was it like to see essentially your childhood on a movie screen when 8 Mile came out? I don't know how accurate it was to what went on then.
Yeah. I had a song a while ago when I said something about a young man in the booth when I dropped 16 and 96 seen proof in the shop. It's like a scene out of 8 Mile, you know? I mean, 8 Mile, it was different. You know, I don't know why they did it that way, but, you know, they had people like battling at the shelter
mm-hmm.
when really people was battling at the hip hop shop.
Which was a clothing store that...
Yeah, which was a clothing store that was owned by Maurice Malone.
Right. And was much smaller than...
And it was much smaller than... And the shelter was where we would go, like, on Friday night. You know what I'm saying?
For shows.
But really, like, Friday night was hip-hop night. So you had DJ House Shoes spinning. You had DJ Dez, Slim Fast, you know. And everybody used to be up in there. Eminem, you name it. Slum, Fat Cat, Royce... Everybody that you see out here now, like, you know, from that era was at the shelter, hip hop shop.
Wow. And you and Royce have songs going back to when you were teenagers.
Yeah.
Any chance of those leaking or what?
They so old, man. I don't know, man. I mean, you know, but we had a song when he was with a group called Wall Street. And then we was over DJ Q House and we was cutting like little freestyles or whatever and all that. And like, through the years, man, I've been on the bar exam.
Fucking with me, Royce Black and June. We'll lay you on your back in the black lagoon.
If this ain't real hip-hop, what the fuck is it then?
Like, he's been on my project. He was on Life's a Bitch.
Early in the morning, dressed in black, yawned and said two of the best is back. Life's a bitch and then you die. That's why we get high, because you never know where you're going to go. Life's a bitch.
You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Off of, you know, the L-Matic or whatever. So
yeah. If people heard those teenage freestyles, would they be able stylistically, voice wise, to recognize each of you? Like, how similar were they to how you guys are rhyming now?
It was a little different, but it was still dope. You know what I'm saying? Like, Royce had this one verse, man, where he it was so crazy, where he was like a virus. And he was talking about entering someone's body as a virus and like destroying like the inside of their body. Like, he was describing all this stuff he was doing. It was crazy.
What do you think it is about Detroit that produces, you know, so many artists? I mean, we could list them for, you know, forever.
Yeah.
And a lot of them have been, you know, through this show, artists and producers and DJs and stuff like that. What is it about Detroit and hip hop?
I think, you know, it's got something to do with the spirit of Motown. I feel like, you know, If we were all, you know, born in those days in that era, we probably would be doing Motown music. Like, but because we grew up in the era of hip hop, we're doing that, you know. And as far as like structure and patterns and all that, I can't really tell you where that come from. I gravitated to that style of writing. And so I was doing that before I met Proof and before I met M or anybody. And I think that's what connected us. Like, once Proof realized and seen, like, I was a fan of that, then we got cool and he became my peoples. And just, we just all linked up. Like, so I don't really know where that comes from. I don't know why we gravitate to wordplay like that, but that's what it is.
Interesting. And, you know, I have to ask, on Egocentric, you have a funny reference to a proton pack on there.
Just know I plan to blow mine's back. Rip the most, sip a toast and whip a ghost like a proton pack. While I catch a massage by who I'm menaging with. Y'all fraudulent as a desert with a mirogenate.
You looking forward to the Ghostbusters reboot?
You know what? I haven't seen too much about it.
Yeah.
See, I mean, I'll go check it out, man. I heard Nas got a part in that movie too, so I'm gonna check that out. See what it looked like.
Nice. What else is going on now? You're out here promoting Lead Poison. What else are you touring behind it? What plans do you have?
Yeah. We got plans to tour. We don't have any concrete dates yet, but we got plans to tour and put out more videos and do more things as far as like extensions of the album, maybe like speaking engagements on, you know, maybe depression or something like that, or, you know, just try to, you know, try to help people out. Because when I do these interviews, like I notice, like, some people, you know, talk about their issues, like they feel like they open up to me, or feel like they can open up to me because I brought it up, you know. So, you know, if I could help anybody out, you know, I'm down to do that as well.
And, you know, you mentioned something about, like, once about how in some ways it was tougher for you to talk about what you were going through because of the nature of the kind of music you made and the genre you were in.
Yeah.
That's sort of the whole point of hip hop is to be, you know, it started, you know, started with I'm the best and you're the worst.
Right, right.
And is all about sort of showing, you know, how great you're doing.
Right.
Stuff like that. Do you see a connection there between being unable to talk about your depression and the kind of things about the genre of music you were making?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely, that definitely held me back. Like, I'm like, man, you know, cause like I say, people want to hear high six, 2 16s from me, you know what I'm saying? And it's just like, I got something deeper I want to say. So when I really came to the realization that, you know, I'm like, you know what, let me put this out for the world. I felt like somebody had to do it, you know, cause everybody's too busy, you know, acting like they got their, you know, they stuff together, you know, and I know that's a lie.
Right. And a tie-in to that is social media. I often joke about how everyone's life is perfect on Instagram.
Right.
And I feel like that kind of plays into it too, this idea that like you have this pressure to appear great all the time on social media and that kind of bleed out into the rest of your life.
Yeah. I mean, the whole thing, like whether you filter or whether you take photographs of your money or you're standing in front of cars or whatever. Like, I mean, okay, cool. Like, that's cool and all that's cool. But at the end of the day, people walk around with facades. And then when they get home, they let their hair down and they think about the things that bother them. So, I mean, like I say, somebody had to do it. You know, somebody had to put it out there.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and I'm glad it was you. Lead Poison's a fantastic album.
Good looking. Thank you, man.
Yeah. Also, thanks for coming through the Cypher, man.
Thank you, man.
All right.
Peace.
I was aware of Elzai before Elmatic, but it was that album that really got me into his music. The ambition it took to redo one of the greatest albums of all time, In Your Own Voice, was so big that I was amazed when it turned out to be not only successful as an experiment, but a great album in its own right. Lead Poison is likewise fantastic. As you heard from Elzai in this interview, it deals with serious topics, but has plenty of light, playful, and even hopeful moments along the way. I hope this episode gives you some insight into his thoughts when creating the record. Join us next week when our guest will be Chris Calico. Chris is best known as the foil on stage and on record to Strange Music leader Tech N9ne, but his new album Go finds him grabbing the spotlight as a solo artist. We follow Chris's story from the beginning, and as any fan of his can already guess, he's got plenty of singing and rapping for us along the way. Like I said at the beginning, make sure you never miss an episode of The Cypher by subscribing on your podcast app of choice. If that app is iTunes, it's hugely important to give us a rating or a review.
And don't forget to visit patreon.com/thecyphershow if you enjoy the program, and help us out by becoming a patron. If you want to talk to me or Josh about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see on the show in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sataro.
I didn't know what MC meant.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
My pants might have sagged a little bit.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
And I got a lot of that dark material just on my hard drive that I just felt like, I don't really want to do that.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
He was like slanging them out like the back of the Lincoln, like opening up the truck.
Our intern is Aziza Hassan.
Like, okay, cool. I'm gonna roll with that.
Special thanks to our newest Patreon supporter, Keith Harrington.
You know, I pulled my hat down over my head so wouldn't nobody notice me.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Was it cool for you?